This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Modified organisms, over 90% of the seed is contaminated by genetically modified traits.
So this is not canola that's been consciously bred to be GMO. This is theoretically conventional canola that's been contaminated by farmers. The canola grown by farmers that's GMO that's propagating with other non-GMO crops?
Well, one of the problems with once the biotech industry patents a given plant, in this case canola, it rapidly becomes harder and harder to find uncontaminated strains or stock of that seed, and that's the same with canola. So there's been arguments by people that want to bring canola into the valley that say, hey, we don't have any intention of planting GMO canola, but their argument doesn't hold a lot of water, because even if they were able to find a conventional strain, that strain would more than likely be contaminated by genetically engineered traits. So just bringing any canola in here by its very nature would be dangerous to the seed industry, but also, yeah, the threat of bringing in a genetically modified plant that spreads like wildfire is very dangerous to the seed system here.
Well, just one more footnote to the canola debate, which is we're not going to be focusing on strictly today, but it seems that in recent weeks there's been decisions on the part of the Oregon Department of Agriculture that are going to make it a lot easier for farmers to grow canola. Is that true?
That's right. The Canola Advisory Committee, or I should say the ODA, just basically made a permanent rule change after a public comment period where there was public outcry and a lot of public opposition to any proposed rule change, because the rule up until recently basically said within a box that was drawn over the whole Willamette Valley with some fringe bits outside the box, you were prohibited from growing canola within that box except under special permit. Well, they didn't grant any permits. And so now they've proposed that they change the rule to shrink the district and allow permits. So as of, I believe, a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, the director of the ODA, Katie Koba, who had the unilateral ability to change this rule, despite all this public opposition, changed the rule, and now you've got the ability for farmers to apply for permits to grow canola. And it's not going to take effect. Well, it's in effect, but they're not going to be able to plant until next fall. So there's still some time before the canola actually gets in the ground. But the fact that they're able to do it now after years of not being able to do it is bad. I mean, back in 05, which is the year when a lot of this started coming back into public consciousness, several farms, my farm included at the time, A2R Farms, we applied for a permit to grow canola. And even though we met or exceeded all of the requirements by the ODA, they still denied our permit on the grounds that it was too big of a threat to the specialty seed industry. They then commissioned a study by the ODA commissioned a study by OSU, and they called it the ODA-OSU Oilseed Study. They started in 06, and they took several farmers, ours included, and used them as test plots to grow canola to see if they could get some more data that would back up any evidence that would say that it could coexist. And the study basically said that, well, we have more questions than we came in with. This just created a whole bunch of new questions. So our recommendation, this is OSU talking, is that we recommend you do not allow commercial scale cultivation of canola. And so here we are a couple years after that, and suddenly the ODA has changed tack. They decided to suddenly start pushing very hard for canola. So hard, in fact, that they were holding meetings where representatives of the specialty seed industry were not informed out in eastern Oregon, where members of the canola lobby, which at the time was a crushing facility in Riccarol and a small handful of growers, they were represented. They gave a presentation, and then next thing you know, the ODA is pushing for a permanent rule change. The Friends of Family Farmers and a few others filed a lawsuit after the proposed rule change. They were granted an injunction preventing the rule change from happening. So then the ODA went into the next phase of their rulemaking process, which allowed for another period of public comment. They held a hearing. Dozens and dozens of people showed up to voice their opposition versus maybe a small handful. I think four or five people, you know, spoke out in favor of canola. But despite all of that, they still went ahead with the rule change and they're allowing canola.
So what's going to happen now?
They're going to start planting it. I don't know how fast or how much, but I think the cap is 2,500 acres per year, and minimum field size is 20 acres. So the canola people say, well, this isn't a lot. You know, we can coexist. And what we've seen in all the other growing regions of the world that have grown specialty seed, vegetable seed, is that once you bring in canola, it slowly but surely pushes out, and sometimes rapidly pushes out, the specialty seed industry. So what we're going to see now is the gradual erosion of our valley as a viable growing region for vegetable seeds for the world.
Well, I saw something on the Friends and Family Farmers website that there's talk about trying to get some legislation passed that would override the Department of Agriculture. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, there's two bills right now. I think there's a House bill and a Senate bill. One of them is a proposal for a valley-wide ban of canola cultivation, Willamette Valley-wide ban, and the other is a statewide ban. I don't hold out much hope for a statewide ban. I mean, they grow it in eastern Oregon, outside of the historical proposed or the historical protected districts. But a valley-wide ban would be great. If it works, excellent. So we'll see. We're still in, I believe, the early stages of that.
So when would that legislation get passed if it were to happen?
It's my understanding that within the next year. So I don't know exactly when.
The legislative session ends in June, doesn't it?
Yeah. So soon, hopefully.
Otherwise, you have to wait 2 years.
Yeah.
And
well,
then
it's
going to have taken hold by then.
That would affect their farmers' ability to plant it this fall, which would be great.
Well, let's move on to the other controversy in the Valley, which is GMO crops. And I've done a bunch of programs about the GMO sugar beets. There's been concern about GMO alfalfa. I noticed on your website there's concern about GMO wheat, where a lot of people who've been kind of nonchalant about the others draw the line at wheat. So how much pressure is there now for GMOs to really make an insurgence in the Willamette Valley?
It's growing rapidly. Like you mentioned, the sugar beet issue has been going on since, I believe, 06, when the two big sugar beet companies in the Valley, West Coast and Beta, switched to GMO sugar beets, Roundup Ready sugar beets, the patent of which is owned by Monsanto. And they told their growers, you need to get on board with the GMO sugar beets or you need to get out of the business. And within 3 years, more than 90% of the sugar beets grown in the Willamette Valley were genetically modified. And it's important to realize that this valley grows, I think, something north of 90% of the sugar beet seed that's used in this country. So this affects a lot more than just a few people in the valley. And then, like you mentioned, the alfalfa, I mean, the dairy farmers are up in arms about this, the organic dairy farmers, because it's getting harder and harder for them to find uncontaminated feed for their cattle. I know a dairy farmer from Polk County who's a grower for Organic Valley who was very concerned. And he said, well, this huge financial burden on us now to not just try to find uncontaminated alfalfa, but also to test all of our seed that we use to plant alfalfa for our cattle. I mean, it's putting all these pressures on these guys that they didn't have before. But now wheat is being grown on small test plots at the behest of Oregon State University. And we don't know where they are, but we do know that there's a lot of pressure from large wheat interests and others to bring in genetically modified wheat, which would be devastating because this growing region, the Northwest, grows a huge amount of wheat, not just for ourselves, but for the export market. I mean, most of the wheat that's grown in the Northwest is exported to Asia. Our two biggest clients, I believe, are Japan and Korea, neither of which accept genetically modified food. So that's been sort of the one bulwark against the wholesale adoption of genetically modified wheat in the Northwest. But I know someone who was just recently at a meeting of the Wheat Growers League, I believe it was the Wheat Growers League, who said that they were looking forward to the soon-to-be widespread adoption of genetically modified wheat in the Northwest. And they're using things like the World Trade Organization to pressure our friends across the Pacific to accept genetically modified wheat. And this is a huge concern because our farm grows wheat and many of our neighbors' farms grow wheat. And this is just starting to take off as a crop that we're growing for local markets here. I mean, if you drive up and down I-5 and you see wheat fields, most of that wheat is never going to make it into the supermarkets in Portland or Eugene or Salem. That's going to end up on a ship and it's going to get shipped to Asia. But there's a growing movement of farmers who are wanting to provide more staple foods for local markets, ourselves included, who see a genetically modified wheat movement coming into the valley as a tremendous threat, because that would mean the pushing out of our organic wheat production.
Now, why do you think this pressure is happening now? I talked with the husband of your employer, Harry Stalford, who runs the largest grass seed farm in Linn County, and he was saying that his theory is that the large corporate agribusiness companies have basically ruined the soil in the Midwest and all the other places that have been cropping genetically modified crops for a long time. And then they sort of discovered our little valley here, and it's a fresh place for them to exploit. And I'm wondering, does that resonate with you, that they have kind of run out of the traditional huge areas where they've planted in the past, and so now they're looking for other verdant valleys that they might come in and exploit?
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, I don't doubt that their aim is to control the food supply, and by controlling the seed, you control the food supply. And they're finding these other pockets of agricultural business. I mean, the Willamette Valley is, to us, a large growing region, but it is a tiny fraction of the Midwest. So you're right, all the commodities in the Midwest, soybeans, corn, rice, all of these things are now, by and large, genetically modified, and it's difficult to get non-genetically modified varieties of those plants. So I'm sure that they cast hungry eyes on the Northwest and said, well, here's a whole other industry, and look at the amount of money they're getting every year from the export market. I mean, Japan pays cash for the wheat that they buy from us. So they're probably looking at that and rubbing their hands together going, we need to get into this business. You know, and they've got powerful allies in the Northwest that probably see it as the wave of the future, you know, adopting these types of technologies. But we see it differently. We see it as a threat to our ability to provide local food and provide healthy food. I mean, it's sooner or later going to be hard to get seed that's uncontaminated if they bring that stuff into our valley.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning here on Locus Focus with Clinton Lindsay, a fifth-generation farmer and a leader in a movement to provide a food bill of rights in Benton County. He also works with some friends of ours, Green Willow Grains in Tangent, providing and hoping to expand the market for locally grown organic grains in the valley that are now starting to serve us up here in Portland. And he's also on the founder and steering committee member of Benton County Community Rights Coalition. So let's move on to that, Clinton. What is the Benton County Community Rights Coalition? Why have you organized this, and what are you trying to do?
The BCCRC, as we call it, formed last March when members of community, Corvallis, came together at a presentation by Paul Cienfuegos, who's an activist from California who had recently moved up to Oregon. And he gave a presentation on community rights-based activism, and specifically as it pertained to banning genetically modified organisms and their associated agriculture. And this got a lot of our attention because GMOs have been sort of a hot issue for the local growers for a while now. And so myself and a couple other members of the BCCRC went, Harry McCormick, who is a co-founder of Oregon Tilth and the First Alternative Co-op and also Ten Rivers Food Web and the Corvallis Farmers Market, who was a neighbor of mine and I've known for a while, was there. Dana Allen, former farmer from Rebel Farms. Shepard Smith from Soil Smith Services. And we after that meeting, we got together and started holding regular Monday meetings. And we formed a group which was then called GMO-Free Benton County because we wanted to ban GMOs in Benton County. And what we came to realize over being more exposed to the work of the community rights movement was that here we had a tool that could potentially give us the ability to effect real and lasting change for some of these very serious issues that we're facing. And shortly after we formed, we made contacts with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, who has sort of pioneered this community rights work. They began in Pennsylvania, and they started offering pro bono legal counsel, and they started helping us draft what later became the Food Bill of Rights. And it took us about, I'd say, 6 months of pecking away at the wording of the ordinance before we felt that it included all of the different things that were important to us. And our ultimate aim was to protect our local sustainable food system. And in doing that, we saw that we couldn't just put a ban on GMOs because that wouldn't enable us to prevent a company like Monsanto from ultimately still being able to come into our valley because they have... Corporations have a lot of protections under federal and state law, and it's because of those protections that they're able to circumvent things like a ban by invoking the Interstate Commerce Clause, the U.S. Constitution, or by state preemption of county ordinances. There's just a lot of roadblocks in the way of a group that's trying to pass a ban on something like that. So we began to become educated about why we needed a community rights-based ordinance in order to do this. And the reason is because we needed to dismantle the ability of the corporations to be able to overturn any measure that we passed in our county. We needed to strip them of their personhood rights as they pertain to the enforcement of the ordinance. We need to remove the ability of the state to say that the rights of a corporation supersede the rights of the people of the county. And we needed to do so in a way that was legally binding. And that's why we wrote the ordinance the way we did. And it, like I said, it took about 6 months, and then we submitted it to the county for review. And the county has a process whereby the election supervisor takes a look at the ordinance. They determine whether or not it meets the criteria for being able to go to the ballot. And one of those criteria is the fact that it has to meet a single subject. It can only pertain to a single subject. And the argument of the county clerk, was that it did not meet the single subject requirement. So the next thing that happened was they sent us back a letter saying, this doesn't meet the single subject. You know, do you want to argue this? And so our attorney, Robert Mugger, who very generously offered some local, you know, daily pro bono legal services, and I take my hat off to him for that, decided we wanted to file a motion to oppose it. So he filed a motion. The county then filed a motion against that. So, I mean, there was this legal back and forth. And in doing that, some other opponents started to show up. I mean, an intervener filed a motion. He was a representative from a large seed bargaining council. I can't remember the exact name of the organization, but we came to realize that that organization was backed by Bayer, which is a biotech firm. So it didn't take very long for the big dogs to start, you know, popping into the equation and voicing their opposition to what we were doing. So fast forward a couple weeks. We were going to be in court for oral arguments where our attorney and their attorney would all show up and argue to the judge why our ordinance did meet the single subject, and they were going to argue why it didn't. And ultimately, they ruled against us because they said, you've got too much in here. You're trying to do this. You're trying to do this. I mean, all of the things we put in there, we argued, were germane to the overall goal of trying to promote a local sustainable food system. And we put in the corporate personhood rights stuff, and we put in the rights of nature stuff, because all of that, you can't have a sustainable food system if it's just going to be attacked 6 months or a year or 2 years down the road by a corporation. You can't have a sustainable food system without giving these rights to nature. Otherwise, it's all just words. You know, you need to have teeth. It has to be enforceable. So now we're at the next stage. We didn't get on the ballot for May, so we're rewriting the ordinance to... It was actually kind of beneficial. I mean, they pointed out the holes in our ordinance, so now we're fixing them, and we'll just apply again.
So is there a way of getting around the single issue problem by having multiple ordinances, which is often what happens on state level and also on local levels?
We met with CELDEF, and that was an option that we discussed, but we all felt that we didn't want to do that. And the reason for that is because what if one ordinance passes and the other doesn't? You know, it just required a logistical and focused political effort that we didn't feel would pan out. So we decided to just alter the wording of the ordinance to be able to meet the single subject problems that came up during the course of our court issues.
So are you shooting for next November or...?
We'll see. I mean, it's still early enough in the process that we're not sure. The court case, I mean, the judge's decision just happened a week or two ago. So we're still talking.
Because if you did it a year from May, then you're into the primary, which is a higher turnout, which might be to your benefit.
Right. And that's why initially we were shooting for November of 2012, because the voter turnout was huge. And it would have been great to get it on the ballot then. But we... You know, there was too much work to be done at that time. So now, ideally, we all want to get it on the ballot as soon as possible. But it probably will take longer than we think. These things always take longer than you think.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what is in the Food Bill of Rights. I have it in front of me here. But what makes this more than just an anti-GMO ordinance? And kind of to back up a little bit, I understand that Mendocino County passed an anti-GMO ordinance of a couple years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
And was that a simple anti-GMO ordinance, or was this more along the lines of being a community rights ordinance?
It was not a community rights-based ordinance. And several people have come to us and said, well, why don't you just try to pass a straight-up ban? Wouldn't it be easier? And our argument is that, well, what good does it do us if it's easier to get on the ballot if a year or two down the road it's struck in state or federal court? So if it takes longer to get the right ordinance passed, that's what we'll do. And you asked a minute ago about what's different about this than a straight-up anti-GMO ordinance. And the biggest thing is that it elevates the rights of the people to decide how they want their food system to look. If you don't include language and in there that elevates the rights of the people above the rights of corporations to decide what they want their food system to look like, it's not going to work in the long term. There's too many tools in their toolkit to allow them to attack our ordinance. So if it takes longer, it takes longer. But we have to have the language in there that elevates the rights of the people above corporations and gives rights to nature. Otherwise, this is not going to work long term.
Well, when I first went on your website and I was reading the general stuff before I got to the ordinance, and it sort of first was reminding me kind of like states' rights, home rule, things that I associate pretty much with very conservative movements. And then I saw what the shift was when you were talking about sustainable natural food systems and natural systems, and certainly did not have the same kind of right-wing spin that a state's right, traditional state's right initiative would have. But I wonder how you separate the kind of locally based rights movement that you're fitting into, separate that from some of the more right-wing movements in the past that have risen to proclaim the need for community rights.
Yeah, that came up at the summit yesterday. Yesterday, we were a co-host of the Willamette Valley Farm and Food Rights Summit. And one of our speakers, Thomas Lindsay, no relation, who's the founder of CellDef, was asked that same question. And his argument was, this is a tool that has been used for many years by various groups for various reasons. And it did come up, said, well, what's to stop Community X in a different state from trying to change their immigration laws, that, you know, or what's to stop this other state from, you know, trying to ban gay marriage or what have you. And argument was that just because a law, a tool could be used for a less than savory purpose, doesn't mean that we're not going to use these tools that would allow us to do good. So I don't necessarily buy that argument as much, because ultimately, what we're trying to do is just give ourselves the right to decide. And I mean, that type of argument could be applied to so many groups. You know, they want the right to decide that, they want the right to decide that. But these rights go above and beyond the basic rights laid out in the Constitution. We're providing more protection. We're providing more rights instead of taking away and drifting below the sort of threshold of that already exists within state and federal constitution.
Well, I see another argument too, which reminds me of arguments that were being made against the anti-gay initiatives 20 years ago that were promulgated throughout Oregon. And the idea being that it goes against the traditions of the Constitution to exclude people and communities from having basic rights, which was the argument against, a constitutional argument against the gay right, anti-gay initiatives. And here it seems to me that what you're doing is you are expanding the idea of inclusivity, so that you are, in fact, not just including people, but you're thinking about natural systems and non-human living beings. And I wonder if you can talk about how that informs what you're doing and the importance of looking at basically broader ecosystems. What is like the legal challenges of incorporating the rights of ecosystems into our framework of laws?
I think it's a whole new way of looking at Western law. I mean, the Western legal tradition for, I mean, untold centuries has been to consider nature as property, and to say that if you own 10 acres, you can do whatever you want with that 10 acres. And that type of thinking has led us to where we are today, which is where we have an increasingly destructive agricultural system. We have increasing levels of disease. We have our pollinators are dying. You know, our ecosystem is suffering, and we've seen where that's gotten us. So it's going to take a pretty radical shift in the current legal paradigm for us to protect what we still have left. And that's why we feel it's important to shift our thinking. And it starts with ordinances like this.
Now, what kind of response are you getting from people in general around Benton County when you talk about this proposed ordinance?
People are enthusiastic because they recognize what we have in Benton County and they want to protect it. And they see the threats that industrial agriculture and genetically modified organisms and the biotech firms that aggressively pursue litigation against farmers who violate patents and technology agreements, they see all that, and they don't want that. They don't want our food systems to look like that. I mean, you go to the Saturday Farmers Market, you go to the co-op, you go talk to people at Da Vinci Days, you go out and you see people and you see the kind of lifestyle we have, and you see this is the kind of place you want to live. This is the kind of place you want to raise your children. And to me, I mean, I have a young daughter. I don't want to raise my daughter in the kind of place where it's not safe to go, you know, to be a farmer. It's not safe because there's poisons in the air. It's not safe because planes are flying overhead and spraying noxious chemicals on every field. I mean, I don't want to live in that environment. And I don't think the people of Benton County do either.
Well, I'm talking this morning with Clinton Lindsay, who is a fifth-generation farmer and a leader of the Benton County Community Rights Coalition, working to get a food bill of rights passed in Benton County. And also, Clinton's real involved with creating or helping to create a wider base for growing local sustainable grains for local markets here in the Valley. I want to talk a little bit more about what sets apart, well, particularly Benton County, actually by contrasting it with Linn County. Because I think about Benton County, I think of lots of great large and small produce farms and old hippies who have actually turned into viable business people. But one farm in particular has been going on for a really long time. Specialty seed growers, both organic and non-organic, and lots of produce and beginning to be some grains. I think of Linn County, I think of grass seed. So I kind of want to do a little contrasting of your two counties and see if there's been any melding of the minds between the people of both Linn County and Benton County around issues like growing canola and GMO.
Well, you're absolutely right. Benton County, I mean, it's OSU is there. It's much larger than any community in Linn County. There's a lot more money in Benton County. It's much smaller than Linn County. You have a lot of large produce farms, but you also have large grass seed farms, large grain farms, and there's a lot of contrast in Benton, but you're absolutely right. Linn County is much, much larger. I would say more conservative. It is the grass seed capital of the world.
They took the sign down, by the way. I was wondering if it's no longer the grass seed capital.
Oh, there's still one on I-5. There's still one on I-5. But you're right. It is going to be difficult to bridge that gap in a lot of ways. But I think that we're already seeing it happen because my employer, Willa Coberly, and her husband, Harry Stalford, run one of the larger grass seed farms in Linn County. And Harry Stalford was at the summit yesterday, and he's virulently opposed to GMOs because he sees them as a threat to not just a small pocket of organic farms over here on the other side of the river. He sees them as a threat to his business. I mean, he's had buyers tell him, you know, you better not let this kind of stuff happen in your business because we'll stop buying from you. I mean, his finger's on the pulse of that business, and he understands what it would mean. So the people that understand the implications are already starting to get bought in. So it may take us longer to build a solid foundation in Linn County and places like it, but it's going to happen eventually if we keep working hard.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Harry Stalford, because I find him a fascinating character, and I've really been enjoying getting to know him over the last couple of years. And he really turned out to be very different than I was expecting, because I first heard about him from Harry McCormick and from Willa Coberly and her mother, Jan Mercurio. And he was this difficult, ornery, grass-seed farmer who just didn't believe in organics, and he was really fighting it every way, and he thought his wife and his mother-in-law were crazy to be doing this. And now, the last couple of times we talked to him, he celebrates himself as an organic farmer. And of course, still the majority of his fields are growing not non-organic grass seed, but he's definitely on the side of the organic sustainable hippies in Benton County. I mean, he seems to really understand where you're all coming from and really supportive of it. Not only that, understanding his own interests lie that way. I wonder if Harry Stalford could shift, if other grass seed farmers also could start to see that their interests are much more aligned with those of you and Ten Rivers Food Web and all the other kind of countercultural groups that have formed in Benton County.
I think you're absolutely right, because you can't argue with results. And years ago, Willow was after Harry to let her grow organic food on some acres. He gave her some small amount of acres.
11 acres, I think. They had 10,000 acres then.
That's right. But it worked. And so the next year it was more and more and more. And now they've got 500 certified organic acres under cultivation, which is much more than most farms in the valley. So it's growing every year, and he is a convert. I mean, but you're right. There are still thousands of conventional acres at Salford Seed Farms. Because I can't see it happening overnight. You know, I can't see 6,000 acres turning into organic overnight. It's a long process and it takes a long time. But he has shown a lot of courage to be able to do that because, and my dad is the same way in many ways. When we started transitioning our farm over, you'd see these messy, weedy fields, which, you know, they look messy to a conventional farmer, and he'd look at it and just, you know, his hand would go to his forehead and he'd just be like, oh, God. You know, he'd drive by and he'd just kind of avert his eyes for a minute. You know, he started calling our weedy field. He started, that looks like potpourri out there. What are we, potpourri farmers now?
Now, was this like the organic experiment was yours, not his, I take it? Were you kind of like the Willow Coberly to your dad, Harry Stalford?
In some ways, but it didn't take him long to get bought in. I mean, he knew the benefits. It's just he'd grown up in the chemical world. He'd grown up spraying Roundup and 2,4-D. And I mean, that's the world he came from. That's the way things were done. So to ask a guy to switch overnight is asking a lot. But the fact that both Harry and my dad did what they did and saw the light as quickly as they did, I think is a testament to their integrity.
So when you go around talking to farmers about the proposed food bill of rights, what kind of response do you get from the grass seed farmers?
I can't say I've talked to a lot of grass seed farmers, honestly. I think I need to start doing that a little bit more. I think that now's a good time because after the summit yesterday and after, you know, seeing Harry there and the response that we've been getting, I think the time is now because once we rewrite the ordinance, that's when we're going to start needing to build a coalition. If we don't have a fairly good-sized group of farmers from across the spectrum, I mean, from the homestead scale all the way up to the Stalfords and the Vanells of the world, then we're not going to be able to really do this thing. So, yeah, we need the support of the big growers as well.
Well, let's talk a bit more about some of the real special things about the Valley that want to be protected. I mean, I visited Gathering Together Farm a couple summers ago and got to see all the test plots they have for different kinds of vegetable seeds that they develop. And I've run into this, I can't remember the name of the farmer, there's a seed farm in Lebanon or Sweet Home that does a whole lot of production of seeds. And I see their seeds are being sold all around Portland. So what is going on here, the sort of well-kept secrets of the Willamette Valley, and how do you propose to protect that?
I think that over the past 10 years or more, there's been this influx of farmers who see Oregon as the kind of place they could go to start that kind of a business. And by that kind of a business, I mean these seed savers, these heirloom seed growers, these heirloom bean growers, these ancient grain growers. They saw all of these factors that existed in Oregon, the educated consumer base, the thriving farmers markets, the rapid expansion of CSAs, community-supported agriculture, and they saw a perfect mix of conditions where they could exist and do this type of a project. And now it's almost like Oregon is becoming a great example of what can happen when a lot of these things happen together. And that's gotten people excited and it started to gather steam. And so now you've got places like Open Oak Farm in Linn County, which is run by Andrew Still and Sarah Klieger. And they run Adaptive Seeds there, and they sell a wide variety of heirloom seeds and vegetable seeds, beans and grains that have been acclimatized to the valley. And there's people here that see themselves as stewards of the food, and not just a grower of crop X or of crop Y, but they're stewards, they're protectors of the seed and protectors of the food. And we're really fortunate to have those people. And they're here because of the people of Oregon, the climate of Oregon, the growing conditions in the valley. I mean, everything that we have here to create a little bubble of sustainability is right on our front porch.
Well, I think for people who aren't gardeners or farmers might not appreciate the importance of developing local seeds for local crops. So why is it important that we develop seeds here that are going to, why would the seeds that are developed here work better here than seeds that we get from Boulder or Ann Arbor or some other place.
I mean, why do retirees flock to Florida? You know, they love the climate. They thrive in that climate. Same thing with plants. You know, they need an ideal climate in order to do well. So in the Willamette Valley, we have a very cold, wet winter. I mean, we don't get a lot of freezes over the course of the winter, but it's cold and wet. And in some cases, the fields are inundated for months of the year. And our soils are heavy clay soils for the most part. So you need varieties that can succeed in those conditions. And one of the challenges in particular with our farm and with some of the other bean and grain farms has been finding varieties of grains and beans that can succeed in that climate. And that's why years ago when Willow wanted to plant hard red wheat for the First Alternative Co-op, other farmers told her, oh, you're crazy, it'll never work. This valley you can't grow that stuff here. Well, here we are 8 or 9 years later, and it's one of our biggest crops. So it may not work overnight, but farming isn't about overnight success. Farming is about slowly building the tools you need to be able to provide a stable foundation. And that's what's been happening. And it's taking a lot longer than we thought for some things, but other things are happening quicker than we thought. So it's just about taking the time you need to build the seed.
Well, I'm reading about natural selection right now, and I'm thinking about things that Willow told me about. Basically, she's working with nature and nature's ability to do natural selection to have the seeds that she originally got from Davis, California, and some other seeds that were developed, I don't remember where, and then they get some seeds from Eastern Europe and bring them to their farm and work with, I mean, basically where they plant them over and over and select the seeds that do the best.
That's right. That's how it went with the red wheat. I don't think that Willow got her seed back the first year. She planted a couple bags and it was a net loss of seed, but she kept what came up and planted it the next year, and it was a small increase in yield. And, you know, year by year, you build the tolerance for cold, cool, wet conditions, and the seed starts to respond. And you're absolutely right. It is about natural selection. And it's about working with the processes of nature instead of against them. And that's why Willow's big on what she calls, she's opposed to what she calls replacement farming, which is organic farming, which substitute an organic amendment for a conventional amendment. So in other words, oh, this is the time of year when we'd be spraying a fungicide, for instance. Well, instead of spraying an organic fungicide, let's not spray anything. Let's just use the tools of nature. Let's use crop rotation. Let's use cover cropping. Let's use other less impactful tools to get the job done, and it takes longer, and you won't have as big of yields, and ultimately you're fine. You won't make as much money off that acre as you might have if you had spent more money on organic amendments. But ultimately, for the long term health of the soil and for the food system, it's the right way to go.
Well, I guess it's also a phrase that's thrown around, regenerative farming, which is the idea that, in fact, I was looking at this other book this week about these two guys who bought a lot in Holyoke, Massachusetts, which was just a totally degraded city lot with compacted soil and all kinds of invasives growing, and decided that they were going to do permaculture there. And the idea being that you try to make the soil better than it was, as opposed to just kind of not letting it get worse. Is that something that you see as important principle, even in our beautiful soil that's not quite as horribly impacted as urban ghetto soil?
Absolutely. I mean, to give an example, on our farm several years ago, when we decided to convert our entire farm over to organic, which had been in conventional cultivation for decades, the soil was basically dead. It was an inert medium, more or less. I mean, if we didn't pump it full of fertilizer and pump it full of fungicide when it got wet, then we wouldn't have a crop. And so you have to rebuild the soil slowly and surely, and that takes a lot of time and a lot of work. I mean, it is a hard and long process to be able to rebuild soil that has been pummeled to death by industrial ag for decades. And using compost tea, crop rotation, green manure, all these sorts of things are tools that you have to use to rebuild your soils to be able to provide a really healthy and nutritious source of energy for those plants. And I mean, one of the best examples is Harry McCormick's farm, Sunbow Farm. He's been farming organically on that ground for 40 years. And you go out there and his topsoil is so deep and his soil is so rich, and it's because he's been doing it for so long. And it's not like it's impossible to get to where he is. It just takes time. And you got to be able to absorb the body blows that are going to come to you in the form of, oh, this big bill is due this year, and gosh, we need to just plant another crop of wheat on that field, and oh, we don't have enough money to really put the amendments on it that we'd like to. But, you know, those are the kinds of hard financial decisions that farmers make every single day. So I take my hat off to the farmers that have the courage to be able to take those risks and do what is necessary to rebuild the soil, because it's not easy.
Well, it seems that all the struggle of just trying to get the valley back to where it was before it started getting pummeled. How do you see the threat of GMOs and canola? How do you feel that you can face that off and protect what we have and continue to regenerate it?
Well, it's kind of twofold. On the one hand, you need consumers that are going to say, we're going to spend our money on this. We're going to support the farmers who we feel are doing the right thing, who are farming sustainably, who are being proper stewards of the soil, and not spend their money on genetically modified food. I mean, that would be a huge, huge boon if a larger group of the population started doing that overnight. But also, the way that they farm when they bring in GMOs doesn't just bring a seed with it that can potentially contaminate our seed and then we'll lose our organic certification. It goes a lot deeper than that. I mean, this is a whole method of farming. The companies that make GMO seeds also make the chemicals that spray on those crops. Like Monsanto makes Roundup Ready soybeans, for instance. Well, they make Roundup too. So their sales pitch is plant our seed, bigger yields, and less chemicals every year. In actuality, you're buying way more Roundup than you were before, you know, and your yields will ultimately be the same or lower. So their arguments don't hold any water. It's all about money, sales, control.
Well, we're just about out of time, but this is a conversation I want to continue. So let's do this again in a couple months, and maybe you'll have a progress report on how your bill's coming.
Thanks, Barbara.
We've been talking this morning with Clinton Lindsay, who's with the Benton County Community Rights Coalition, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Actually, what you'll really need to do is do a search for today's show, the date, Locus Focus, and it will come up that way. And someday we'll fix the website and we'll have our old page back. Next week, we're going to talk about the threat to biodiversity from overpopulation with Leon Kalantzowicz. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Carlos Chavez. We're going to go out with some music for March by Cassandra Wilson. Thanks for listening. The wind in the wood, a cliff of foam, a scratch of it is nothing. At all, it's the wind blowing free, it's the end of a slope, it's a beam, it's a void, it's a hunch, it's a hope, and the riverbank talks on the waters of March, it's the end of all strain, the joy in your heart, it's the joy in flesh on the bone, the bend of the road, a slingshot stone, a fish, a flash, a silvery glow, a fight, a bet, the range of a bow, the bed of the well, the end of the line, the dismay in your face is a loss, it's a fine, a spear, a spike, a point, a nail, a trip, a drop, the end of a tale, a truckload of bricks in the song.
How I'd love to wander back.
Hi there, this is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO. You.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is 11 a.m. Stay tuned momentarily for Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Alma Midwifery, offering prenatal care, home and birth center, birth and mother baby care for the first 6 weeks postpartum. Alma Midwifery provides relationship-based care with certified nurse and professional midwives, as well as childbirth education, yoga, and parenting classes. Located in the heart of Portland at Southeast 16th and Ankeny, or almamidwifery.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is Dr. Victoria Mazes. Dr. Mazes is Executive Director of the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine and a Professor of Medicine and Public Health at the University of Arizona. She's co-editor of Integrative Women's Health and lectures worldwide to academic and community audiences on women's health, aging, nutrition, and cancer. Dr. Mazes is here today on Health Watch to talk about her new book, Be Fruitful, The Essential Guide to Maximizing Fertility and Giving Birth to a Healthy Child. Welcome to Health Watch, Dr. Victoria Mazes. You there, Dr. Mazes? Well, looks like we might be having a little bit of technical difficulty. So everyone just hold on the line and hopefully we'll get Dr. Mazes on soon. So a couple upcoming shows. We have Dr. Rosen coming next week to talk about natural alternatives for treating children and children, common ailments for children. And then the week after, we're interviewing a woman who went into rehab centers to look at addiction and addiction treatments. So stay tuned for those. I think we might have Dr. Mazes. Are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. I'm glad we got you. So, so in reading "Be Fruitful," your book about treating fertility, one of the things that really struck me was the fact that you talk about not only treating people who are having trouble with fertility, but also anybody who wants to get pregnant. It's advisable for them to actually prepare beforehand, and that it can actually change outcomes for people. Can you talk a little bit about why?
Absolutely. So that is one of the primary messages of Be Fruitful. We are exposed to lots of things that not only affect our fertility, but also affect the health of our future child. They include the